Okay, so we have a minor miracle. I've actually got the stuff up onto the screen without any major issues. So we'll get started now. So last time we looked at some basic aspects of probability. So for both discrete and continuous, that's how you assign likelihoods to both discrete and continuous spaces. And so we had this idea of you've got an experiment with a set of outcomes. You then need an event space, which is some sets of those outcomes. And somehow you can attach a probability measure to that. We ended up looking at random variables. The idea behind those is that we attach numbers to events and then somehow construct sort of a probability assignment for those numbers. Okay. And typically that's done by assigning values to half intervals, or from minus infinity to some point. So you get the probability that your random variable is less than a certain point. We're going to continue with some properties and definitions around random variables. And then we're going to start talking about stochastic processes. Essentially, those are random variables that have a time evolution component to them. Okay, and we'll at least try and see how we can put some manners on that sort of an entity. Okay. So, most people will be aware of the definition of the expected value of a random variable. So, this is related to the idea of an average value. Okay. We have, essentially, it's a probability-weighted average of the value, of the values taken on by our random variable. Okay. So, in the case where we have a finite set of values, so our random variables are drawn from a finite set, then we can define directly a PMF for each of those values, so that we can define directly the probability that x equals any given value. We'll call that pi. And again, our expectation e sub x is just the sum of x times our probability. Okay. So, you know, if we had a simple example, you know, the outcome of a single roll of a die. If we assume that each side is equally likely, then the expected value will end up as 3.5. One thing to note about that is what you can see there is the expected value of an does not necessarily have to be in the space of outcomes. So, again, in terms of terminology, our expected value is referred to as a mean value of x, or the first moment of the random variable x, and we'll be continuing on with this discussion of moments. And we often write it as x bar. Okay, so that's reasonably straightforward. Just to have a look at an example, we want to find the expected value of a random variable x, where px of k equals 1 minus rho, rho to the k. Okay. So, we can calculate that explicitly. So we get e to the x is the sum k times the probability of k, and then, which is 1 minus k, rho is a constant, pull it out, so you get k rho to the k. If we could get rid of this k, we'd have our sum rho to the k. So we do a little trick of saying k rho to the k is the derivative of rho to the k times rho. Okay, so if you took the derivative rho to the k, you get k rho to the k minus 1. So you need to add in a rho. Then you have your derivative. Or you can pull the derivative out. We know that this sum is 1 over 1 minus rho. And take the derivative of that, and we'll get our rho over 1 minus rho. Okay. So we would expect that we could do something similar for continuous random variables. Okay. But again, we will struggle to find to assign the probability for a continuous random variable. We can't assign it to any given point. We'll need to use something like a density function. Or what we can think of is looking at the probability that you fall in any small interval. Okay. And so then, again, our expectation is that we can write our expectation in terms of now some sort of PMF. And then as we shrink the size of our interval sort of infinitely small, then that translates into an integral. That's the integral of df of x. Sort of x df of x. Okay. Where, again, f of x is going to be our cumulative distribution function. Okay, so again, as we shrink our interval, that sort of approximation becomes exact, and we can note that df of x, so the derivative of our cdf, is our pdf. And so, yeah, that makes intuitive sense. Okay, so again, if we look at an example, we can, if we're given a PDF for a random variable, we can sort of directly calculate what its expected value is. So in this case, we have our PDF for an exponential. So we have lambda e to the minus lambda r. R is greater than 0. Lambda is greater than 0. And so the expectation, we can just directly calculate by taking the integral of r times the PDF, dr. You will need to integrate by parts to do that, so you split it into two sections, and when we do that, we see that we get our expectation is 1 over lambda. Okay, so that gives us one way of characterizing our random variables. Something that we do very often. We often talk about averages, average values, okay? The average mark in a module is, you know. If you're worried about, say, your likelihood of passing the module, then the average probably isn't the only thing to be concerned with. But you can also think about sort of how do the sample points distribute around that average. Okay, so I tell you the average in this module is a 70. You guys are all very happy. And if things are tightly clustered around that 70, you've probably got good reason to be happy, right? But where are we? 40B? 40 would be around here then. Maybe the clustering isn't very tight. Maybe there's a tail here. Okay. Then probably at least one of you had better be worried. Okay. So it's just saying that, yeah, the average only gives you a certain amount of information about your distribution. Okay, so another common measure is what we call variance, and so again, that's going to measure the spread of probability mass around our mean value. Okay. So do the likely samples spread out, or again, are they sort of going to be, by and large, tightly clustered around the mean? Okay. And so the variance is defined as the expectation of x minus the mean value squared. Think about why we would need to square that. Well, if you just took the expectation of x minus the mean, you're going to get the mean minus the mean, or zero every time. So you need to sort of account for pluses and minuses around our mean. Okay, and so if we look at the variance, let's see, again, if we expand out our x minus expected value of x squared, you get expected value of x squared minus 2 times x times expected value of x plus expected value of x quantity squared. Okay. And so, again, that works out to the expected value of x squared minus our mean squared. Okay. And so that's falls out of a few properties of means. You know, it's the mean of the sum of two random variables is the sum of the means, and the expectation of a constant is the constant itself. So we have two components there. We have our new component, expected value of x squared, and then we have, again, our old component, the square of the mean. We refer to the expected value of x squared as the second moment of x. Okay. And if we continue on, the expected value of x cubed is the third moment, etc. And so why are we interested in these? Well, the moments in and of themselves can be of interest. They can tell us something about our distribution. If we have all moments, then all moments completely characterize our distribution. It relates to our mass function. And also, in some cases, it's going to be easier. We're going to be able to find fairly straightforward ways of calculating these moments. Okay. And instead of, you know, again, having to grind out our integrals every time, we'll see that there are sort of shortcuts to that. Continuing with an example. So this is our exponential distribution again. And we now want to find the variance. So we're going to have to evaluate the expected value of x squared, then subtract off our mean squared value. Okay. And so, again, if you do integration by parts, you'll arrive at the idea that our expected value of x squared is 2 over lambda squared. Now we subtract off the mean squared, which is going to be 1 over lambda squared from before, and we get 1 over lambda squared. Okay. And so we can keep sort of, if there's a, for any, again, sometimes the cube gives some information as well. It tells you about how the variance then is changing. And so we can keep grinding these out explicitly by doing our integration. Or we can look at what's called, Okay, well, run ahead of myself. Okay, so again, we have our nth moment. We can calculate the expected value of n is just the integral of xn times your density function. So we can keep grinding those out, doing our integrals, and we can phrase that, or else we can recourse to what's called a moment generating function. And what we'll see is that we can relate our moment generating function we can pick out various moments reasonably quickly. Okay. So our moment generating function is the expectation of e to the tx. So
What does t day represent? The time or something?
Nah. It's just any real variable. It does and doesn't represent time in the sense that it doesn't need to mean time. It just means, although it is, you know, something like time in the sense it's continuous. Jumping ahead, we'll see that it's related to time in the sense that we can relate our moment generating function to a Laplace transform. So you have T, and then you'll have the transform S. But T is just a continuous real variable for our purposes right now. And what we can observe, we can note is that if we look at the Taylor expansion of e to the x, then that's 1 plus x squared over 2 factorial. And so when we take our integral, we can plug in the expansion of e to the tx, and if we examine each of those terms in turn, we see that we get our function. The components of our function are our nth moments. Okay, so we get our nth moments times some function of t. And so what you can think is that if you're clever about it, you should be able to pick out the moments of t, the moments of x through your moment generating function. Okay, how would you do that? Well, you can do it by taking successive derivatives and evaluating those derivatives at t equals 0. Okay, so if we take the first derivative of our moment generating function, your constant, the derivative constant is 0, dt of x bar goes to x bar, dt of any subsequent term will still have a t factor in it. So when you evaluate that at 0, they all cancel out. Okay. So you can get the nth moment by taking the nth derivative of our moment generating function and evaluating it at 0. Okay. So, what that says is that if we can calculate this moment generating function, then it's frequently easier to take derivatives than grind out the integrals. So we've made an easier problem for ourselves than popping out the moments. So to calculate the moment generating function, well, again, we can directly solve the integral. Or if we make one assumption, which is that our random variables are all non-negative, so from 0 to infinity, then our moment generating function is related to the Laplace transform. In particular, the Laplace transform of our PDF is mx to the minus s, evaluated at minus s.
Okay.
So what that says is that if you know what the Laplace transform is, then you can relate, you can pop out the moment generating function. Okay. And so using this, we can derive a expression for our nth moments in terms of our Laplace transform, and so we get a minus 1 to the n factor. We take the nth derivative of our Laplace transform, and again we evaluate that at 0. Okay, so like this gets a bit fiddly, but again, we might just primarily for noting that you can do this. Okay, so if we return to our example, we know what the Laplace transform for our exponential PDF is, and so we get the Laplace transform. Then again, we can pop our moments out by including our minus 1 to the n term, taking the nth derivative of our Laplace transform, and evaluating it at 0. Okay, and if you want the variance, of course, that's a combination of these moments. So, again, it gives you a number of different ways of approaching this idea of calculating moments. A similar parallel concept exists for discrete random variables. We have now what's called a probability generating function. And so if we think of our random variables as taking on some subset of non-negative integers, then we can define the probability generating function gz is the expected value of z to the xk. Sorry, z to the x. Okay, where z is a complex variable and px is our probability mass function. And so, again, gz is the z transform of p of x, px. Okay, so the discrete analog of our Laplace transform. Okay, things are a little, you have to be a little careful with this. If we start taking, you know, start taking our derivatives and try and pick out specific terms. And if we take our derivative, our first derivative, and evaluate it at z equals 1, then we do pop out our first moment. If we look at what happens with the second derivative, well, we actually end up capturing a combination of the second moment and the first moment. So you can subtract off your, or you can, if you calculate them sort of iteratively, you can remove the components as they arise. Okay. Now, a trick which, again, allows us to pair off that unwanted component is to take the derivative, then multiply by z, and evaluate, then take the derivative again, evaluate it at 1. And similarly, if we want the ith moment, then we take the I minus 1th derivative multiplied by z, and then take the derivative of that and evaluate at 1. Okay. So again, it's a way of finding moments without necessarily having to grind them out by direct calculation. So, we can, again, look at this with a Poisson distribution. And we calculate GZ to start with. And so it's going to be the sum of... to the k times our PMF at k, and so we end up with we pull out our e to the minus lambda, and then we end up with a term which has again an exponential distribution or an exponential representation. So we get that gz is e to the z minus 1 lambda. Okay, once we've done that, so we can calculate our moments through this combination of derivatives and occasionally multiplying by z. Okay, so to get the first moment, we take the derivative and evaluate it at 1. We get lambda. To get the second moment, we take the derivative. We multiply that by z, we take the derivative again, and evaluate it at z equals 1, so we get lambda squared minus lambda. And if you want the variance, then of course that's the second moment minus the first moment squared. Yeah.
This PMF is probability mass function. Mm. What is the physical meaning of like probability mass function? Like we know that for probability density function, it is the probability.
So if you have, what a mass function is, it's saying that if you have just a discrete number of points, think of it as finite for now because that's the easiest, then you can write down exactly, you can give a number to what the probability is for each of those points. So what the likelihood is that your variable is one or the other of those points. Think of a coin flip. Then you have 2 points. Well, call heads 1, random variable. Call heads 1, tails 0. So you can assign explicitly a probability to each of those values. So 1 is a half, as probably a half. 0 has a probability of a half.
What would the probability be?
So you can write it down explicitly. And then what we said, the difference is for if you have a continuous variable, you can't write down the probability for any one point because it's all zero. I wouldn't think of it as a histogram because a histogram is like if you're observing a lot of different samples. So you can use a histogram to derive your PMF, but your PMF is actually a value assigned to a point. Okay, so again, that's just a few properties associated with random variables, and so that allow you to sort of characterize the either a density function or mass function of a random variable. Using this succession of moments, and again, if you know all the moments, you can characterize exactly what your function looks like.
Stochastic and random process are same.
We haven't started on stochastic yet, so we'll be defining what stochastic process is. Okay, so the second topic, which we're going to start today, and again, what we say today is slightly abstract. We'll start looking at sort of more concrete examples next week. But we'll try and get sort of an idea of what exactly a stochastic process is today, and we'll move into sort of when can we say something interesting about them. Okay. And what we're interested in, we could say, are systems. And systems typically evolve over time. Okay. And that time evolution, we typically talk of as moving from one state to another state, and we try and characterize how that happens in time. Okay. Now, it's possible that you have a system that you turn it on, and that evolution is completely fixed. What we're interested in is systems that are evolving in time, and there's an uncertainty about how that evolution plays out. Okay. We refer to such a system as a stochastic process. And so what stochastic process does, it tacks on this notion of time to our notion of randomness. Okay. And so formally, we define our stochastic process as a family of random variables, which are indexed not only by omega, but also by t. So what's happening is, is evolving through time. Okay. And a lot of times we'll sort of vary omega and either call it x of t or x subscript t. So that evolution can either happen in a discrete fashion or a continuous fashion. So we can think of sort of jumping from moment to moment to moment, or sort of again as a continual evolution. And so if we think of some fairly simple example, and maybe a cue, and if we think of the number in a cue, then this is going to be dependent on how things arrive to the cue and how they depart the cue. So any given sample will exhibit some behavior, but there's an infinite number of possibilities. Oops. Okay. So we can look at that in a number of different ways. First of all, we can say that for any given value omega, then what we're left with is a function of time, so something, so a fixed evolution through time. Now, if we fix t, what we see is that for any fixed t, there's no certainty as to where what state we'll be in, where we'll be, what the value of our random variable will be. So for any fixed t, we have a random variable. Okay, so there's some possibly hard to think about unknown distribution for the value of xt at that point. And of course, if we fix both omega and t, then we have certainty, we have just a fixed sample value. Okay. So, again, we have, for just in terminology really, if we fix omega, then we call the evolution x of t a trajectory or a sample path of the random process. So if you, again, start your system, then observe your system running, you're getting sort of a single observation that's based on a single omega, and it's just one sample of the possible paths through that could occur. Okay. So, if we knew the probability distribution associated with omega, then we can, that governs the likelihood of different trajectories, and that in turn governs the likelihood of observations at any single point in time. But again, frequently it's sort of difficult to say much about that. Okay. And so again, if we fix t, then we say xt of omega describes the likelihood of different values, states of the process. So again, what that means is that, again, when we fix time, there is, at that given time, a specific distribution associated with the values of the random variables. Okay. So there is some way of assigning either a PMF or a PBF to the random variable. At a different time, you'd have a different distribution, potentially. Okay, so let's look at an example. So we have a game where we're tossing a coin an infinite number of times. So that's your underlying sample space. That gives you your underlying sample space. And the random variable we're defining is that if we see a heads, we add a point. If we see a tails, we subtract a point. Okay, so we keep a running tally then of heads and tails. Well, not a running tally of heads and tails, but a running score. Okay. So we'd like to describe this this process as a stochastic process, XTW, XT omega for positive T. Okay. So our underlying set of outcomes is, again, an infinite sequence of heads or tails, or pluses or minuses. And we can define a probability, a measure over that, just by assigning the probability to either observing a plus or a minus. Okay. So the score, so our stochastic process, we end up with XT omega. It's the sum I equals 0 to T. So how many points in time have we gone through of our observations of plus or minus 1? Okay. So we can look at how our samples are going to evolve in time. So, you know, we start at 0, we toss one coin, and either it's heads or tails, so either we have a score of 1 or minus 1. Okay. So, what's the probability? This probability is a half at either point. And what we see there is, again, if we observe, if we fix time, so t equals 1, then we've got a random variable with a distribution to it. We get a half, it's 1, and a half, it's minus 1. If we move on to time 2, then what are your possible outcomes? Well, if you have two heads, you have an outcome of 2, a score of 2. If you have two tails, you have a score of minus 2. And in the case you get a head and one head, one tail, you have a score of 0. We can again assign a PMF. If we fix t equals 2, we can assign a PMF. So the likelihood of two heads is a quarter, the likelihood of two tails is a quarter, the likelihood of one head, one tail is a half. And so what we can see is, well, on the one hand, it's a simple enough system that for any fixed point in time, we'll get, we can grind out our PMF. On the other hand, we have to do it explicitly for from one time to the next to the next. Okay, so in that sense, and also as we go out to infinity, what we can see is that the number of possibilities is increasing. Again, to infinity, so it's going to be difficult. Well, it's going to be impossible to assign a PMF at that, or it's unlikely that you'll assign a PMF at that point. So, what we see is that it's on the one hand, a straightforward problem. On the other hand, it's a bit difficult to sort of reason about the system in its entirety. Again, the system as you're going out off to infinity. Okay. And so what we're going to be doing as we go along is trying to put some restrictions on the properties of the systems that we look at so that they're of a type that we can reason about more readily. Okay. So how do we sort of classify our stochastic processes? Well, you can discuss the state space, the nature of the time, the underlying time, and also the nature again of the underlying distributions. So, first the state space we so what's possible values or states can xt and omega take? Then it's either discrete, so you have countable or finite, so 1, 2, 3, 4, or continuous, so evolving continuously over time. Similarly, our parameter space, so our value t is either discrete or continuous. Okay. And those two are, yeah, that's straightforward enough. Will make some difference in sort of how we approach reasoning about the system, but you do more or less the same things. Okay. What's more important, again, in order to be able to reason mathematically about it, is what sort of statistical dependencies exist among the x of t omega for different values of t. So, again, you have a distribution at one point. Does that tell us anything about the distribution at any future point? Okay. And what we'd hope is that it does. Okay, because if it doesn't, then your system's very random and there's not much you're going to be able to say about it. Okay, now before sort of digging into what our possibilities are for statistical dependencies. We need to characterize what we mean by dependent and independent random variables. And so we say that random variables X and Y with corresponding events X less than some value little x and Y less than some value little y are independent if for all X and Y, the probability that X is less than X and Y is less than little y is the probability is the product of the two probabilities. And so what that's saying is essentially that knowing something about Y does not tell us anything about X and vice versa. Okay. So if this is not the case, again, then the random variables are not independent. Okay. So our requirement here sort of fixes it to a single event, and what we say is then for all events, we need this independence property to hold. Actually, whether or not this holds, we can define a joint distribution function of x and y, where fxy is the probability x less than little x and y less than little y. If they are independent, then that's just ends up as the product. And we can define a joint density function on the two random variables as well by taking the derivative with respect to x and with respect to y. Okay, so what we've done is we've gone from a probability space on one random variable to the probability space on the product of the two spaces. Okay. Okay, so again, an alternative definition of independence is that the joint distribution function is the product of the two, or the densities is the product of any individual density. Okay, and so we can extend that idea out from two random variables to however many n random variables we want. Okay. So if we think of our stochastic process as some infinite sequence of random variables indexed by Ti, so we're observing at various points in time, then the question is, are the observations related or not? Okay. So we can define our joint distribution function. And we have an independent process if one distribution is not dependent on any other distribution. Okay. So, again, if any observation is not dependent on any previous observation, then the thing's pretty random. And again, there's not going to be a lot we can say about it. Okay. So, what we actually probably want is that there is some dependency between various observations or various the distribution at various times. Okay. So, we can define our dependencies, and we can define them in terms of conditionality. So we start with our joint distribution function, and then the conditional probability is given by probability of x less than x, y equal to y. Given is the probability of x less than x given y equal to y times the probability that y is equal to y. Okay. So, again, in terms of notation, we shorten that to f of x given y, or sometimes y. Or f of x given y equals y. Okay. So, if they're independent, then, you know, again, as before, that will fall out. What we want to look at in particular is, again, conditionality on previous behavior for our stochastic process. And so we can say that the distribution function for n for our n random variables, each at time n, can be written as in a conditional way. So it can be written as f of x tn, so the distribution of the nth random variable given our previous history times the probability of our previous history. Okay. So essentially what that's doing is it's saying, well, I've made an observation up till now. Can I say something about what's happening from there? And so, if each observation is giving you a different answer, then again, it becomes very complex. Okay. So, what we're going to do is we're going to sort of limit. We're going to try and limit the form of that and see what we can say about it if it's a bit constrained. Okay. see where we are in the notes. I think I'd like to, I'd like to get the Markov chains. We're almost there. Okay, so if we return to this idea of our characterization of our statistical dependencies, we've taken that little sidebar of just sort of characterizing what dependence and independence means. We can make a couple of definitions. We say a stationary process is a stochastic process whose joint distribution function does not change with shifts in time. That is, if you go any fixed time forward, you get the same distribution. Okay. So if you went here and then sampled a fixed time forward, you'd observe the same amount of the same statistical behavior. Okay, and so obviously stationary gives us some nice properties. It means that, you know, as time goes on, we can expect it to behave the same, the system to behave the same, not deterministically, but, you know, around the same probability distribution. Finally, our last definition is an ergodic process, and here we can deduce a full description of the process from any single infinitely long sample path of the process. And so what that means is that as we go on, we can, again, decide not only what's happening with that trace, but what's underlying any other trace in the system. Okay, and so there's a few properties that fall out from that. One is that your system has to essentially exhibits some sort of almost periodicity. It has to return to its previously visited states. And also that after some suitable time period, what's happening is no longer dependent on what happened on your starting point. Okay. So those are going to be two sort of nice properties for our systems to have, and we're going to essentially assume that the systems we're looking at have those properties. So that's a lot of sort of technical details. With our last topic today is to look at a very specific sort of stochastic process called a Markov chain. And again, what we're going to see is that there's constraints on the behavior of Markov chains, and these allow us to attempt some sort of reasoning about, again, these underlying distributions. So we'll have a break here, and in the, let's say, 20 minutes, we'll come back and look at what we can say about sort of these very specific sorts of stochastic processes.